Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We are looking backward and forward this week as we explore where the local food scene has been and where it's going. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we talk to Chef Stephen Oakley of Oakley's Bistro, wine and spirits expert Arthur Black, longtime local service professional Sherry Clark, and restaurateur Deb Borschelt of Bee's Po' Boys and a co-founder in 1986 of Basbo Pizza. We've got a lot of local restaurant history here today and plenty of ideas on where things are headed and what needs to improve to get us there. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Start looking back at the Indianapolis area restaurant scene to sort of figure out where we've been and where we're going, you have to look back at least 30 years. Now, that sounds like a lot of time. In fact, some of our top chefs in Indianapolis right now are only around 30 years old themselves. But some of the influential names on the local dining scene today were just getting started in the late 1980s. One of those is Chef Stephen Oakley. He graduated from culinary school in 1990, worked for Chicago chef Charlie Trotter and other restaurants, including Benvenuti in Indianapolis, before landing at Something Different, the groundbreaking Indianapolis restaurant that was started in the 1980s by chef couple Drew and Susan Goss of Indianapolis. Now, Oakley remained at Something Different. It was highly regarded for its service as well as its food until opening Oakley's Bistro in 2002. So he's seen a lot of change in the local restaurant scene. So we sat down recently to talk about some of those changes. Kind of describe the local food scene when you first started cooking in Indianapolis.
Well, back in, I think, 1990s when I got arrived at Something Different, or actually Benvenuti before that, and then Something Different, you know, we had a food scene that was kind of spread out and distant. Not as many upscale restaurants as they were called last, you know, in the past. You know, there was still, and people might not believe this, but there was still a local push of local ingredients and farm-to-table ingredients. It just wasn't labeled as that back in the early 90s. You know, everything was kind of set to the area you were in or the type of restaurant you were at, you know.
But you were, looking at local ingredients and regional ingredients, you know, and that whole, regional American, you know, had kind of taken off at that point.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was kind of labeled as the Midwest was the melting pot. So it was basically everything from the area, meat and potatoes kind of place. I think it still is in a roundabout way, and that's the comforting side of being in the Midwest. You know, there was a lot of farmers out there, believe it or not, back in the 90s.
I think we tend to think that it's this whole focus on local ingredients just happened like yesterday or something, you know, and really it's been building for a long time.
No, I remember back in early days when Richard Catance in Zionsville had a huge herb garden out back, and you know we all were like jealous of what he had, and so that's when we searched out and at Something Different, and we had a guy in Rocky Ripple that was actually a farmer growing a lot of our herbs and lettuces and so forth, Cinderella pumpkins. That's actually kind of how our soup has evolved over the last 25 years. So they were out there, but they were in a different form. They weren't at a farmer's market. We didn't have those, and we're very fortunate to have those today. But they were a little bit harder to find, but very eager to provide you with things.
What were the diners like in the early 90s?
I think the diners in the early 90s weren't as finicky as they are now. I think they were, I think as far as unique ingredients of sweetbreads and things like that, they were well receptive to that, as they are now. I think we have a lot more well-traveled people in the Indianapolis area that helps us bridge that gap of unique ingredients to them, and they kind of search out and look for those.
So as something different, you know, kind of describe the experience there and what that was like.
It was a pretty interesting experience. You know, I started out with the Gosses, which kind of the pioneers of the food scene here in Indianapolis. And at that time, everybody wanted to work for them, you know. And we've had, there's 30, 40 people across the city now that have kind of made their mark and put their feet in the sand and said, I'm going to do this. You know, you have someone like Arthur Black that started out as a busboy, talking to me behind the restaurant every day about what this was and what confit was and so forth. And, you know, he's evolved into this great mentor of wine and spirits and a true passion for it. You know, you got Roger and Cindy Hawkins that both work for me and work for something different that have found their niche. So I think they were kind of the building block of the success of a lot of Indianapolis today and a lot of the people that are still around, you know. You have Tony Hanslis that now at the Chef's Academy kind of doing. So we've all found our different avenues over the years and have become just watching the food scene grow. And, it's very exciting. It really helps us being where we're at to do what we do and be around for the 14 years that we've been doing this.
So in the early to mid-90s, the food scene, I think, was changing, you know, and people were getting, you know, more adventuresome, maybe, more interested in what was going on. Have you seen a progression, you know, in either the diners or the chef community, you know, how that has changed over the years?
I think the chef community, obviously there's a lot of different programs that are going around, the Chef's Night Out and all that, and focusing on some of the sous chefs and other cooks is a great thing, great exposure, gets them out there, gets them in a situation that they're normally not in on a day-to-day basis. There's with all the culinary schools we have here now, a great influence of chefs to pick from or work with interns. The dining scene, as far as the clientele, I think the city is just growing tremendously, so we're getting a lot more people from the East and West Coast that understand food and understand different ingredients and allows us to pair them with some of our local things that we have in the Midwest and keep it a little bit more interesting. So I think they're diners, I think they've kind of gone back from the basic meat and potatoes to accepting, things that have, two or three combinations on a plate and make sense as a whole. So what we call the 3-6-9, where you have your starch, potato, and veg is gone away. Now you can kind of get away with not having all that on a plate, as long as the main ingredients, the star, the focus.
Where do you see food going, you know, here in Indianapolis? You know, we've had an explosion in the last couple of years of, you know, new local restaurants, you know, chef-driven kind of places. Do you see that expanding? Do you see, will we reach a saturation point?
Well, I think, it's expanding now, and I think as we get some of these younger chefs and some of the older guys as well that have done different types of restaurants realize that there's a market for a lot more variety And hopefully, we see that with the chefs, so it's not just one common menu locally. You know, we have, a variety of cuisines and ethnic sort of influences of, Mexican seems to be the hot new flavor profile right now of putting that into your menu. People like it, they accept it. But I think it's going to grow. I think it needs to, it'll level off to at a certain point from the beer, from the wine, from the food. And hopefully it becomes more consistent throughout the whole city, and that'll help us grow as a city and as a food scene.
We've been talking with Chef Steve Oakley of Oakley's Bistro in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more from Chef Oakley here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are looking at the evolution of the local dining scene here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio today, and we are talking with Chef Stephen Oakley of Oakley's Bistro. He opened the restaurant located at 86th Street and Ditch Road in Indianapolis in 2002, and he's seen a lot of change when it comes to local dining. We talked about how restaurants have changed, as well as how local diners have changed. And we talked about where the restaurant scene is going and about what we might see along the way. What about fine dining as we've known it? Is that still, viable? Has, the sort of casualization of restaurant dining, played a big part in the changes that we've seen?
Well, I think fine dining, the word fine dining has kind of gone away, and now it's just become fine food, no longer do you have to wear a coat into a certain restaurant or, have white tablecloth to be considered fine dining. I think fine food has overcome the whole fine dining aspect of it needs to be done in a sterile atmosphere. Now it's more of a fun, casual atmosphere. Come as you are, enjoy the food, enjoy good wine, spirits, and so forth. So I think we've kind of jumped over that hurdle and are past it as far as fine dining goes. It's nice to see a few places that still maintain that, but I think for sustainability of a restaurant, you have to move past that and kind of be an open market to everybody.
How do you keep that focus on service, though, without that stuffiness? I mean, that's been kind of the thing, when you... as dining has evolved from, you could say the stuffy, white tablecloth kind of thing, to more inviting and more casual, but then you still want to keep that quality service. You've talked about all the training that you do.
Yeah, I think the staff training is the crucial part of what we do day to day. And what we tell our staff is the biggest thing is you don't want the guests to know you're there. You want their experience to be what their experience is with their conversation at their own table. Obviously there's a beginning and middle and end part of a meal as far as service goes, but the service is really a point that you need to be aware of the table and understand them and just be there, but not really, So that's kind of what we preach is, do what you need to do and let them, if they want to interact and talk about food, then they're there for that. If not, you got to kind of read them and move on. So that's our approach to service.
And then tell me about the training that goes into that kind of thing, because that can't be easy, to make sure that your servers know the menu, know everything that they need to know, and can then do that.
It's definitely a personality-driven position as far as a server goes, and every restaurant has a variety of servers. We have certain servers that are different with a different type of clientele, but they really have to know the menu, know the food, know the wines, know the spirits, and kind of just really just sell the product as easily as without being too abrasive in their approach. you know, we always tell them, if you know, what do you recommend? And it's not what we recommend. It's, you almost put it back in their lap and you say, what do you enjoy eating? Do you like seafood or meat or a more vegetable-based diner? And try and get some of that information out of them and just make them feel casual and make them feel comfortable is the biggest key. Obviously, pouring the wine and opening a bottle of champagne and is steps that you have to take, but we do a lot of that before they even see the customer.
Now, what about you as a chef? You know, think about, you know, your career, you know, here in Indianapolis and you know, what you've done and where you're going. What do you see, you know, still coming down the road?
Well, I see down the road here, I see a lot more, you know, a lot more smaller places that have kind of a niche in their area, in the area that they're going to be in. You know, I still think it's somewhat meat and potatoes in a sense. You know, so we still try to hit those marks, but I think it's growing at a pace faster than it can sustain right now, and it'll slow down over time, and they'll figure it out, and they'll find their mark.
Any trends that you've spotted that you know, that you see that have come and gone here locally, or that we might be going to see sometime in the future?
Well, I think you're gonna see people searching out for other ingredients outside of their normal Indianapolis area, because there's a lot of great products in the surrounding states and so forth. So I think we'll see a lot more chefs looking out there and finding different types of ingredients. We're always trying to look for something that, you know, nobody else has, or a unique a technique. You know, I'm looking at almost going more back to the early 90s. And, you know, a chef always said, just don't try to reinvent the wheel. Just make it a little bit straighter, you know. And so go back to what made you successful. And I look at dishes every day from menus from 20 years ago. Okay, that was a great dish. How can we make it in today's environment? Or does it fit in? Because I think food eventually has come back to good, solid cooking and good fundamentals of cooking versus trying to be too gimmicky with some of the techniques. You know, and so I think trendy for me is going back to what made my success early on and trying to reproduce that years later with a lot more local product and, you know, product from afar.
Are you excited about where the Indianapolis dining scene is headed?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a big excitement. I mean, it's glad to see. I'm glad to see, you know, some chefs that work for me that kind of making their, you know, their mark right now and, you know, have a bright future. But it's fantastic. There's a lot of accolades that some chefs have gotten over the last year. It helps our whole dining scene, you know. So I know people get jealous of one or the other, but you know, in a whole, you know, we're only as good as our first restaurant and our last restaurant and everything in between. So if we all can be strong and successful, I think more people will venture to Indianapolis and, you know, just getting them out to eat and understand that there's a lot of variety out there now.
We've been talking with Chef Steve Oakley of Oakley's Bistro in Indianapolis. For more information, go to oakleysbistro.com or look for the restaurant on Facebook. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. We are talking about the local restaurant scene today on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. And when you talk restaurants, you have to talk service. And in many cases, you have to talk wine as well. And to get that perspective on the Indianapolis dining scene, we are talking today with wine and spirits expert Arthur Black of RNDC. Arthur was part of the team at Something Different in Indianapolis back in the day, a restaurant that we hear a lot about when we talk about the development of Indy's restaurant scene. I talked with Arthur recently about the changes he's seen locally, where we're going, and what we still need to do.
I think you have to give credit to where credit's due for the older institutions that have had long-standing, ambitious beverage programs that might have done Ghirardin cart service or decantation or had old world representations on their list or even, you know, back vintages and verticals. And with these accounts, we're talking about Carriage House, you know, we're talking about accounts like, you know, St. Elmo's and Peter's and, you know, and a handful of others that are either still with us or unfortunately not with us, Something Different, of course. And these, this was a different style of dining. There was a degree of formality in some cases, verging on the side of a militant, dining, which I had the pleasure of working at a couple of those places and, you know, would have it no other way, but it's not what we're doing today. And I'm honestly all right with the trade up. I shouldn't say trade up, but trade over into a different genre of dining. It's a faster pace now. It's more casual now. It's a little bit more relaxed now. But I don't believe the food and the array of food options has ever been more diverse or been better. I don't think we've had a stronger farm-to-fork movement than we currently do have now. I don't think it's ever been more widely embraced by Hoosiers and other people in the Midwest starting to recognize what Indy can offer as far as a destination city in terms of gastronomy. And with the beverage thing, we've gone a different direction. We've really taken off with our beer and our cocktail and our craft cocktail movement, and I've been pretty entrenched in that. And wine, I should say the formality of wine maybe has taken a little bit of a step back or just slowed its pace. But if you look at the lists, there's still never been a better selection available in the city. They just don't have the depth of old Bordeaux or old Burgundy, and that's not what a lot of younger consumers, I think, are looking for. They're looking for maybe a smaller list that has more breadth and is more comprehensive in terms of having an Assyrtiko from Greece or having an Albarino or a Cadeo. So the lists that we have they're more casual in terms of formality, but there's a lot more options in this city than there have ever been before in the way of esoteric and emerging wine trends.
So how did that happen? How did the change happen? Can you pinpoint any reasons or when or why?
I think from the wine side, historically, our wine experts in town were few and far between. There were largely, you know, fine wine salespeople who did their due diligence to go out and sell their product. There were restaurateurs and a few, very, very few specialized persons. I think nationally we've come to appreciate wine to a greater extent, and that has slowly creeped its way inward into the Midwest. I mean, America for the first time ever last year became the world's largest consumer by value and volume of wine, which is totally unprecedented. There's really a pretty savvy wine community here in Indianapolis, even though they haven't really been getting the kind of credit as the brewers and the bartenders lately.
Well, now that is interesting because, of course, there's been a huge explosion in craft beer, and that gets a lot of attention. You know, but there hasn't been as much attention to wine here in Indianapolis, although I get the feeling that that might change.
As much as I've been involved in the bartending and the craft cocktail scene lately, I really kind of want to make a personal endeavor to get back to increasing wine consciousness and awareness, and more importantly, most importantly, I should say, because it crosses over into the other genres of alcohol, the servicing of it. And I think maybe that's where wine is kind of fell a little bit behind, is we have all these great independent local eateries that by and large have been adopting this more casual approach to service where it's faster pace, the food's still killer, you know, and I see servers that take pride in working at establishments that serve food made from local goods. And, you know, the scenes are lively and active, and there's a vitality to them. But I personally feel, amongst a handful of experiences where I've been around town, where, you know, not everybody's presenting that bottle of wine the way they should. Maybe they're not doing it from the correct side. Maybe they're not as up to speed on their own knowledge from a service staff about wine. Wine can be very complicated. You know, it can be a little bit easier to memorize the ingredients in a featured cocktail than it can to be able to speak to some obscure grape variety in this northern Italian red wine. With wine, there definitely has to be a leading from the top and a training to service staff and an observant eye to watch the dining room and make sure that the staff is doing what they're supposed to be doing. Somewhere along the lines, we've forgotten what's most important in a restaurant. It's great to have awesome food, and it's great to work for a chef who takes serious pride in what they do, and there are so many here locally in town, and it's good to work in a really cool and fun and exciting and hip environment. We have so many of those accounts, but ultimately, what's most important is the guest.
Maybe service isn't up to where we might want it to be.
In one sense, it's a lot to ask a service professional who is working at a higher quality establishment, whether it's casual or not. Like, if you're serving killer food and you're charging a premium, that doesn't negate the importance of knowing all of your specials, knowing all of your cocktail features, knowing your beer program, knowing your wine program, and potentially out of all those things is this world of wine. You know, I mean, the beer world is vast and the cocktail world is vast and craft spirits are getting larger. But if you do look at wine and wine producing countries and wine flavor profiles and the thousands of great varieties out there and the hundreds of appellations that over the years I've memorized and the hundreds of soil structures that sadly, yes, I've memorized, it can be a lot to ask a service professional to learn, but it doesn't matter. If you work in a restaurant that charges a premium, you should be giving high quality wine service. So you learn everything that you should with the obligation that you are able to help facilitate the dining experience, and you always make it about the guest. So that's knowing knowledge you should know. Food specials, cocktails, wines that are in your program. It is always about the guest. If you don't get them back in to the restaurants are not going to be sustainable. This isn't, you know, we're not talking about a line outside of the Golden Corral here. We're talking about independents that need to maintain patronage. And the server is one of the most important pieces of a restaurant.
Tell me a little bit about your history in serving in Indianapolis. And people a lot of times bring up something different. You know, and I've talked to a lot of people lately who refer to the service team there as something really special.
There was a period that I experienced myself at something different where it was a few year stretch where just everybody was awesome. Everyone did their job. Everyone had their strengths and everyone, you know, had their weaknesses, but others compensated for it and they always stepped up. And it wasn't even like, you know, we were pulling tips or whatever. There were some of us that really embraced the beverage program and could go out there and sell and sell and sell because of our excitement and our understanding of the beverage program. And then there are other people that could carry their load and carry a weight in a lot of tables. And if they had too many people and they needed an assist from someone to go over and help, then we would. And the management staff was wonderful. And then, of course, you know, this is the first time I was able to work for Steve. I went to him over at Oakley's. But it was a great restaurant. It really, really was. It was a wonderful experience to be a part of that team.
How do you cultivate that?
It's rare, but it comes down to pride and everybody doing what they're supposed to do, you know, integrity. I can't say I've been a part of really any other restaurants or have witnessed as a trainer or, you know, consultant in any capacity where everything just clicked and worked and, you know, there were, you know, virtually, you know, never any serious issues and, you know, everyone did a great job. So I can't speak to how or why that ever existed, but it did, and it was nice to be a part of it.
So how has the dining scene changed?
It's changed dramatically, and it seems to be moving still further in that direction, and I'm fine with that direction. As long as we maintain standards of service or continue to appreciate the value of the customer, of the guest, that to me is primary. That everything else is secondary. I mean, would I like to maybe have a really white tablecloth restaurant in this town that does do guillotine service and has a, you know, fromagier on staff and all this stuff? Would it be nice? Sure. Would I rather have 10 restaurants that are pumping out killer food and, you know, they might be playing more casual music or they might be a little bit dressed more casually, but everyone there cares about what they're doing? I'd rather have the latter, because to me we're increasing a broader base of customers, and we need that. This town has opened so many new wonderful establishments that I personally am very proud to have in the community, for whatever that's worth. And I'm proud to take my friends and peers and colleagues when they come to Indianapolis into.
We've been talking with wine and spirits expert Arthur Black of RNDC. Stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When I began thinking about how the dining scene has changed in Indianapolis, I posted about it on Facebook, as I usually do when I've got a question about the local food scene, and sure enough, I got plenty of responses. One response was from local service professional Sherry Clark, who says she has always worked in restaurants in some capacity or another. In fact, she was on the front of the house team when Something Different opened. Now, we've heard a lot of references to that restaurant here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio today, from Chef Stephen Oakley, as well as beverage professional Arthur Black. And as Sherry tells us, there was just something special about the Something Different team.
It was so interesting. There was, you know, not much like it in town. For me, you know, every single week, every menu were items that I'd never heard of, food items and techniques. And, you know, they started by changing the menu weekly, which was crazy. They cut that back a little bit, but we had a wonderful tasting. Every new menu, went through every item, you know, ingredient by ingredient. You knew the menu. You knew how the food was made. You knew what was in the food, and you were able to explain that to the clients or customers in such detail. People were incredibly excited. They instantly had a cult following. Because the food was just that good.
This was like the late 80s, right?
That sounds about right, if not early 90s. But there wasn't much going on. You had Peter George, and you had the classic restaurants. You had St. Elmo's, which was, again, the phenomenal wine list, the shrimp cocktail, but it wasn't cutting-edge food by any means. And you had the old standbys that were wonderful things to go to for atmosphere, romantic, and all of that sort of thing. But again, you know, pretty much standard fare, not like new and inventive food that people weren't making at home. And, you know, that you could get really excited about and get wowed by. Everybody's had a ribeye, you know. But when you can go to a restaurant and week after week or month after month and get something you've never had before that is so incredibly beautiful to look at. The aesthetics were amazing. But every ingredient, the freshness, the care, the love that went into it from developing these recipes. And a lot of research went into that. You know, they've always had their finger not just on the pulse, but a vision of the future, and they did. They weren't just doing what was popular today. They were doing what would be popular in the many, many years to come.
So I think in that way, you know, Drew and Susan Goss were pioneers of, you know, of what's happening now.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I think all the explosion of the wonderful restaurants that we have today come from a lot of different factors. But if you go back as far as the region goes, as far as Indianapolis goes, you can definitely go back to those early pioneers. And so that when these restaurants did start to open, they were successful because people had had a taste. Now they wanted to taste some more.
So tell me what it was like launching Something Different, how the team felt, you know, and how the service was.
Everyone was really excited. I will say a little Larry, are you going to make enough money to pay your rent? Because are people going to come? You know, they were pioneers. There were empty nights where things were lean. But in time, and not a lot of time, you know, there were nights we were turning a lot of people away. And that happened in a short amount of time. So that was pretty exciting. To the point they were able to expand to Snacks Next Door, which was really exciting, bold and innovative. It's a tapas bar, not a topless bar.
I think that's so funny. It's odd to think now that people didn't know what tapas were.
No clue. And then, you know, you explained it's small portions and everything. Oh, what a great concept and everything. But, yeah, the word tapas threw 9 out of 10 people. It was very funny. And they didn't hear anything but topless. That's exactly what it went to every single time.
That is so funny, you know, that word, you know, that has become such a part of the restaurant lexicon, you know, that you know, it just wasn't out there then.
Right. Well, you know, borrowed from another culture. So now it's small plates, so, which is what it always was. But, yeah, it was pretty exciting stuff.
So what was the reaction from customers, you know, to this sort of different restaurant? I mean, seriously, something different.
Again, it was pretty much a cult following from the get-go. You know, we had clients that came in at least once a week, week in, week out. You know, I had a great number of clients that I served every week. And so did the other servers there. You developed a relationship with these people because they were there so often. We definitely had our fair share of people that came in once and never came back because we didn't have what they were looking for. And that's okay. There is an Olive Garden. It's over there in Castleton, you know. Go. Enjoy yourself. Really.
So you mentioned well-oiled machine, and other people have used that phrase to describe, you know, the service at something different, and, you know, how well-trained everyone was, you know, and how it worked. Was it really that good?
It really was, and I will have to give it to Drew and Susan for they were not just managers. They led by example, and they praised their employees. Instead of beating people down, which is so often the case, they minimized the "you did that wrong" part and maximized that. That's wonderful. Thank you for doing it. You know, thank you. You're so important. You know, they really lifted people up.
How do you cultivate that? How do you cultivate that great service?
Yeah, and there's two things that comes to mind there. One, the owners giving it back to us. And two, we had, luckily we had a team that was experienced, and not all of us were experienced in fine dining, but we certainly came together and we were mature about it.
Talk a little bit about the wine program there, because that was a very big deal at the time, wasn't it?
It was a huge deal. Like most good restaurants, we had wine and services, so we had wine reps coming in, making, you know, training us on a regular basis about the list, so we could, you know, we learned to pair those wines. We learned not just to suggest of sell, but to do it right and make sure, again, that wine that we suggested was the perfect match. And that was very important to Drew and Sue's.
So that raises up a question. You know, how have the diners changed?
I know 22, 23-year-olds that know more about wine than the general public did back then.
As far as food goes, then, how have people changed? You know, are they more adventurous than they were? Are they, you know, were they, or have they always been sort of willing to come along with a chef, with a restaurant, you know, that they trust?
I think they're far more adventurous. Even back then, when there was something that pushed somebody's boundaries on the menu, they would opt towards the steak off the grill, you know. Raw is everywhere now, but raw was a big no. People did not do raw. And I mean, who doesn't do raw now?
Where do you see the local food scene going? You know, what kind of trends have you seen lately, and where do you think we're headed?
For me, one of the most exciting perspectives on the local scene is the shop local movement. And the food scene, by far, leads the way on that. And do the more nutritious thing, the tastier thing, it all makes sense. But it's a hard barrier to break for a lot of restaurants. It's daunting. Bringing that all back to something different, that whole spark started with Drew and Sue's Goss. You know, I fell in love with sauces. I fell in love with flavors that I'd never experienced before. I learned something. I paid attention to what they were doing, and I learned so much.
We've been talking with local service professional Sherry Clark of Indianapolis. Stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. We've talked a lot today on Eat Drink Indiana Radio about the evolution of Indy's dining scene. But casual dining was starting to change 30 years ago as well. Gourmet pizza came to Indianapolis in 1986 when Basbo opened in a little house in Broad Ripple. Basbo co-founder Deb Borschelt, who now owns Bee's Po' Boy in Fountain Square, tells us what things were like in Indianapolis in 1986 and talks about how the dining scene has changed since then and how it still needs to evolve.
I basically just wanted to be an entrepreneur and work for myself, and I did not go to culinary school. I don't have a degree in culinary sciences, but I did have a love for cooking, and I had a real love for people and making people feel happy and comfortable and feeding them. I worked for Fridays Corporation, the old Daltz restaurant, as a server, and I'd done a couple of other things. But then at the time, my business partner and I, when we were looking at various locations around the city, we would have different ideas of what a kind of concept should go there. And anyway, ended up getting into the pizza business in the Broad Ripple area. We were kind of the first pizza place in the region to be offering such unique toppings and such a wide array of them as well. I'd say the closest was probably Cafe Spiaggia in Chicago, which I had ventured to a couple of times. So, and that's kind of where I got started with it. Truthfully, never really knew that the concept would still be around nearly 30 years later, but it is, and that's great.
It's kind of interesting when you look back on it, sort of a, you know, a pizza renaissance, you know, in the mid to late 80s, you know, along with some of the, you know, the finer dining.
Yeah, I think Peter George had a lot to do with that. I think Fletcher Boyd had a lot to do with that. I know that those were underappreciated at their time, fine dining establishments that really sort of whetted the taste buds, if you will, of the population of Indianapolis. And people were wanting to have more interesting options for their food, but not necessarily wanting to have to pay an arm and a leg week in, week out for it. And I think that the idea of fast, casual, top-notch quality.
When you were thinking that you were going to, you know, create these, you know, what was called at the time gourmet type of pizzas, you know, what were the tastes like then?
You know, everyone has a different flavor palette, but the situation in my case was at the time I was a vegetarian, and when you're a vegetarian, if you don't want to just eat tofu and beans and rice, you have to start experimenting with lots of different cultures, because there are a lot of flavors in different cultures that are vegetarian, and that's kind of where that started, and that's how the Neptune and the Mexican and the Chapatulas, that, you know, all of which have meat on them, but the vegetarianism for me was created the sun-dried tomatoes, the goat cheese, the fresh basil, and pine nuts, and homemade sauces, and so that's kind of how the tastes went for me.
And that was unusual at the time.
True, true. I kind of like to think of it as a hippie all grown up from the 70s. And I think that's where it kind of progressed. And if you look at today's food scene, they call them hipsters now, but it's not a lot unlike the fact that people care about local. The word locavore has been created. Well, that was exactly what the hippie world was like in the late 70s, early 80s. They wanted things that were healthy and natural, and organic wasn't a coined term yet, but it was headed that direction. And I feel like it, you know, maybe the late 80s, early 90s were a refinement of that.
What was the reaction to some of the different types of toppings and the whole different idea of an upscale pizza?
Well, the reaction was much greater than I expected it to be. People took to it.
Do you think that the flavors, you know, and the different kinds of things, you know, were easier for people to wrap their heads around because it was pizza?
I think that's a great point. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but you're right. It's a little bit more of an accessible food, an accessible price point, casual atmosphere. We tried to create an atmosphere that you could come straight off your bike with shorts and a tank top on, or if you had a tuxedo because you were coming from the symphony, that was welcome as well.
Broad Ripple was different then, you know, but some of the neighborhoods and the whole city was different, you know. So what are some of the changes that you've seen, you know, in some of the neighborhoods, you know, in that time?
I think that establishing the cultural districts of Indianapolis and then connecting it with the cultural trail was huge in development of new restaurants and new entertainment venues, and establishing a walkability, a bicycle-friendly community. As you know, my restaurant now is in Fountain Square. My husband and I have moved down here about 2 years ago, and it's just amazing what we have accessible to us within a mile and three-quarter radius. Like, we walked Colts games, and we can stop at half a dozen places on the way home or on the way there. And people say, oh, you walk to Colts games? And it's only a mile and three quarters. And people in Chicago walk that all the time. So I think that's definitely been a big change, because in the 80s and 90s, this was a driving city. And that was it, period.
So that is a big change, just the sheer numbers and walkability.
Absolutely. Fountain Square has always been a place near and dear to my heart. Even in the 80s, I used to come down here. I remember when the Murphy building was a G.C. Murphy. I knew that it was a special place, and I always thought that one day it would come into itself. And I really believe it's done that now. And we have more exciting things coming. I always have felt like critical mass was important and it was kind of lacking in Fountain Square. But I have to say that that's not the case anymore.
What do you think about the culinary culture in Indianapolis?
Well, the landscape has certainly changed since the 80s. And there's a lot more options for the people of Indianapolis. And yeah, I want to say that the people of Indianapolis have become a little bit more sophisticated. Things like the Food Network, people tune into that, they get educated, and then they're looking for these either items in the grocery store, which are now available and weren't then, or they're seeking out restaurants that offer these type of products. And, of course, we have many more chef-owned restaurants than we did, or at least chef-driven restaurants than we did even in the 90s. So I think that whole culture has changed, not just because of the people in the business, the service people in the business, all working together to make it a better place.
Is there still room for more growth in the
yes,
local restaurant scene? And people talk about needing to grow the pie, you know, because so that we're, you know, every restaurant's not after the same diner.
Oh, within the city of Indianapolis, there's definitely room for more. Yeah, I think there's always room for growth. I mean, look at a city like New York City and how many restaurants are there. and how many more are going to open up this month. Yes, a few are going to close, but some of them are decades long open, and it all has to do with how you make your customer feel and what you offer them. And I think as long as we can stay focused on good quality, good variety, good service, then we'll continue to grow and there'll always be room for good restaurants.
We've been talking with Basbo co-founder and Bee's Po' Boy owner Deb Borchell. For more information on her restaurant, including plans for an Irvington location, follow the restaurant on Facebook or check beepoboy.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Petzenberger. Thanks for tuning into the show this week, and thanks also to our guests for sharing their thoughts and experiences on Indy's dining scene. Chef Stephen Oakley of Oakley's Bistro, wine and spirits professional Arthur Black of RNDC, local service professional Sherry Clark, and restaurateur Deb Borchelt of Bee's Po' Boys. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.